So welcome everyone to our Flash Football Scholars Forum on FIFA Gate. We have several people on the line, Chris Boltzmann, Alex Galarza, Chris Henderson, Daniel. So how do you pronounce your last name, Daniel? Daniel, are you there?
I think it's Reich.
Reich? Okay, David Kilpatrick. Then we have Marcela. Do you go by Araujo?
More Araujo. I'm afraid I use the whole thing.
Okay, you must write very long checks if you still have those in Britain.
Well, I certainly got... My name's too long for Twitter. I don't have checks.
Matt Hawkins. Yep. And Martha Savage, Roger Kittleson, Ronnie Sibaha, and Stephen Apostolov. Did I get everyone?
Yes. Peter?
Yes, Daniel.
Oh, okay. My micro was off. It's Reiche. You know, it's very difficult, but it means rich. So if you want, you can call me Daniel Rich.
DR. How's that?
Yes.
Is that sufficiently Americanized for you? Okay, so let's turn it over to Chris Boltzmann in sunny L.A.
How's it, everybody? Thanks, Peter and Alex, for setting this up so quickly. I suppose I'll kick off and say, as a South African who's written on football, who still tries to play the game and, of course, loves the game, 2010 was an amazing experience for me, but was also very contradictory. I suppose on the one hand, seeing the World Cup in my backyard was wonderful, but at the same time, the question was always at what expense? And I suppose the recent revelations of the South African bribery taint and indeed tarnish this wonderful memory I have of June and July 2010. Having said that, I suppose much of my concern through much of the mainstream media has been that UEFA, the Europeans, will save FIFA. And my concern with this is that there's this underlying neocolonial rhetoric, which I'm very uncomfortable with. A week ago, most people had never heard of FIFA. Now everyone seems to have an opinion of FIFA and Sepp Blatter. And I think that's where the Football Scholars Forum is ideally placed to really talk and comment on FIFA, as all of you have spent years and years researching and writing on football and FIFA in particular. And I really wanted to hear what you as scholars were saying and thinking about the FIFA gate and the way forward for FIFA in the future. That's it, really, Peter.
Anyone want to take a stab at the opening salvo? I have to add somebody else from the to the call. Roger.
Thanks, and thanks to Chris for the brilliant idea, as Peter says. Yeah, this has been obviously an earth-shattering kind of week here. The only sort of joy in football until that weird, weird press conference had been Arsenal's FA Cup triumph. But I digress. As someone who worked on Brazil and lived there on and off and so on, the World Cup was already extremely tarnished for me. But this is bringing things out into the open, and raising a lot of hopes in Brazil for some real change. Though the farther we get from the weird press conference, the less hopeful I find myself becoming. The initial reactions were fantastic. David Goldblatt, suggested it on Twitter that we really need something like a world social forum for football, which I thought was a fantastic suggestion. Instead of just waiting these months for Blatter to sort of line up his chosen successor, which I think is a more realistic outcome. So I guess I just want to start off with this sort of mixed sensation. Because it is, wonderful that, this guy has been forced out. As Chris says, there's this, horrible kind of colonial thing that's come up, even in the writings of some people I, I genuinely respect. I think Simon Cooper's been guilty of some of this in the Financial Times, but a lot of others. And, you know, we need to remember what Stanley Rouse was like, what Johansson was like, and we do not want people like that back in charge. And but neither do we just want, you know, bladder butt from a different country. There's my massive emotions just to start things out there.
Alex, you'd like to follow up?
I think Daniel was ahead of me.
Hello.
Okay, Daniel.
I think we do not only have to give our opinions, but also to, as scholars, to ask the right questions. And I mean, I have more questions and would be interested about what you think about it. Like one thing, I tweeted an hour ago an op-ed from the New York Times from today where somebody demanded that the one country, one vote rule in FIFA should change. So I would be interested in your thoughts. Do you think it's fair? So this the guy who wrote the article is suggesting that the number of votes should depend on the number of players in the country. I mean, since I'm German, it would be fantastic for my country. But I mean, in Germany, I think the German Football Association has 6 or 7 million members. There are other countries with just a couple of thousand. Do you think that's fair? I mean, there are examples for everything, like the U.S. Senate. Every state has 2 senators, regardless of the size of the state. EU Parliament depends more on the size of a country. German Football Association, I checked it, which I find interesting, has 16 state federations that member, and every state has a different number of votes depending on the size depending on the number of members in the state association. So this would be one thing I would be interested in to hear from you. On June 11th, the FIFA seems to present something like the IOC Agenda 2020, like a reform of the 2026 World Cup bidding process. And I think we could discuss like the criteria. What should be the criteria for World Cup? I mean, I remember when the World Cup 2006 in Germany was, there was a campaign by Scandinavian feminists to boycott the World Cup in Germany because prostitution is legal. So it's, I mean, what I want to say with this example is it's always a very interesting question where to draw the line. So is it that a country should allow like unions, something like in Qatar is not the face, etc. So where to draw the line? What should be criteria for the new World Cup bidding process? And finally, I mean, it's interesting to see, I mean, in general, the reform agenda like term limits, should other stakeholders like Human Rights Association be involved into FIFA decision-making process? But it will be also interesting to see like the role of Switzerland. I mean, so far, international sport governing bodies like FIFA, they are non-profit organizations. They do not pay taxes or hardly any payers taxes. They are exempted from many laws, such as those on corruption. I think this will be also interesting, like whether Switzerland will change. There seems to be some pressure in Switzerland to have a more effective oversight of international sports governing associations. So, and maybe finally, future World Cups are decided by the whole assembly, by all the 209 member states, not the executive committee. How will this change the selection process? So, sorry for not giving any answers and just asking questions, but I would be interested about your thoughts.
Anyone care to jump in? I'm desperately trying to get Simon Cooper in on the call, and Skype is not letting me, but I'll keep trying while you speak. Anybody?
Feel free, anyone from the chat who's been talking. There's a lot of discussion there. Or Marcela, you were about to say something.
No, only because I thought you had said me next or something on the chat, so I'm trying to follow both the talk. But yeah, no, I mean, the most interesting thing for me this week, being in London after 3 years in Argentina, is the it's not a hint of colonialism or imperialism. It's the kind of the absolutely extraordinary, overt language with which, you know, the African and Asia are dismissed in one. I mean, I hear it over and over, and I don't know if it's the same in the US, but the kind of repetitive and all sorts of news commentators, journalists, a lot of very different people from very different backgrounds and viewpoints just say, well, it's a bunch of Asian and African small countries, and it's almost, they're almost talking as in charitable terms, as if the new FIFA that should bring the World Cup to England should also give a little bit of money to these small people from Africa and Asia who deserve the. And I find that very, very surprising. And I think it's something that I have been thinking for a long time, and it's only articulating itself this week, which is that certainly for Brazil and Argentina and possibly for a few other South American countries, this whole FIFA participation and this kind of role that's now becoming so infamously predominant. So, you know, Julio Grondona, who's been named as the treasurer who signed various authorizations for money to move from one way to the other, or, you know, Brazil in itself, the whole history of the Brazilian family in football. It's, we have never felt as citizens of football fans or as football, as people who work in the football industry, as a third world small nation that, you know, has kind of, Brazil and Argentina, and indeed Avalanche and Grondona, created this monster. Blatter just came along and kind of said, okay, well, I'll support you or whatever, or I'll continue to play this game. So it's a very interesting shift. And I think it's possibly been in the cards for quite a long time that the European sense that this, what they're calling the third world or the developing world's power should somehow be reined in, because it was getting a little bit out of control. And without buying kind of wholesale into the conspiracy theories or the Putin angle, I think it's very interesting. It's very interesting to see how this whole scandal has somehow allowed the rhetoric of these poor, small and corrupt others who need to be curbed or, you know, somehow contained. And on that basis alone, the idea that every country shouldn't have a vote worries me. I mean, to me, the principle of one country, one vote should actually be sacred.
David and then Stephen.
Well, I have to strongly disagree, and I think maybe accused of an American bias, but I actually spent most of the past week in one of the quote-unquote Caribbean nations and in Cuba, holed up in a hotel with Pelé, of course, and you know, I had the chance to meet with the president of the Cuban Federation, absolutely wonderful person, Luis Hernandez, and didn't only meet with people at the highest levels of the game there, but had the chance to meet with kids as young as 6 and 8 years old, actually playing the game on fields that have vines growing through them, and just have the love of the game in them without any sense or care or concern about all of this stuff that the rest of the world is fixed on. I think the principle of proportional representation is a really important one to keep in mind here. And that doesn't mean that the big nations get to gobble everybody else up on this. The player registrations, let's say a nation like the Netherlands can, this should incentivize people to give the franchise to their players. And I think proportional representation needs to happen at the level of each national federation as well. If a country like the United States has so many players then those players registered ought to have more of a voice in the game's governance. But I think we need to be careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater here. The water is spoiled, it's rotten, but the baby is the game, and we need to nurture it. There are a lot of babies out there playing the game, and that's what it's really all about. And I think the media here that I'm seeing, and again, I was very much disconnected while in Cuba the past few days. We had very, very limited Wi-Fi access, so the news broke as we were waiting to get on the bus to go to the stadium for the Cosmos to play Cuba. It was a lot of word-of-mouth stuff, but So I haven't been able to read all the articles everybody else is talking about yet of the past 5 days. But I think we need to be very careful how we move forward here. I love Goldblatt's suggestion. I think when you see when you give a coach a bag of 15 balls and he's got 15 kids there, is he going to give each kid a ball? Or is he going to keep all 15 balls for himself? Corruption starts at the grassroots, my friends. And I think we need to think through this very, very carefully. That's enough for now.
Martha, and then Stephen.
Yeah, okay. I think on the issues of governance, this is maybe where scholars could come in and really look at, you know, the systematic evidence on different kinds of nonprofit large organizations. But the thing that I really wanted to mention or just raise was, you know, there was a funny kind of backpedaling by a lot of the corporate sponsors, like, oh my gosh, you know, we just want to see this be clean and we want this so wonderful. But where is the money coming from? It's coming from the corporate sponsors. It's coming from, you know, the businesses. And so that side of the equation, I would love to have access, and someday we will, I guess, to all the FBI files to see, you know, who is corrupt. And you have similar efforts going on in you know, governance worldwide and in the business community after the financial crisis, you know, lots of different things with banks and all that. What is the clarity of the books? How, you know, how do these large companies run themselves? You know, maybe the person at the top doesn't know that the person on the side is taking a bribe, but they're still responsible. And I think that in the corporate setting, it's been okay. And, you know, this is the frustration of working, you know, in African studies. Oh, Africa's so corrupt. It's so corrupt. But somebody is paying all these, you know, these practices. And a lot of things, we have a lot more sort of elasticity to absorb this corruption. We don't see it. Whereas, it, you know, any bit of corruption someplace else, because the margins are so much smaller, you tend to feel it a lot more. So I don't know. I that's something that the corporate side of it, I would love to know more about. And there's a few. Actually, I've been enjoying, in terms of sources, BBC Business Daily. They tend to look into this side of things a little more. And so getting some of that perspective would be good. That's it.
Very good point about the corporate sponsors, Martha. Stephen, you're next. I just want to welcome Dan Evans to the talk, to the conversation, and also Simon Cooper, a.k.a. Pamela.
Thanks.
Stephen.
Thank you, Peter. Can you hear me, by the way? Because I'm with a new computer, and I'm not sure if it works.
Loud and clear.
Excellent. I liked what David Kilpatrick said, that corruption starts from the grassroots and everybody points at the top echelons of FIFA, but don't forget that Blatter gets elected. And I bet actually if he runs again after his resignation, he can win again because people vote for him. And it's interesting to ask Sunil Gulati for whom he voted. And there is even a lot of contradiction on American soil because Sunil Gulati is the president of the USSF and he is also director of Kraft Soccer Operation. Don't you see a little problem there? And I'm not going to even talk about football associations of Eastern Europe ran by mobsters. And don't even get me started with the African countries. And that's all I have to say now.
Okay, who'd like to jump in now of people who haven't had a chance to speak, perhaps, yet? Anyone who's given interviews to the media or journalists or bloggers among us who have written about this maybe care to talk about that part of the experience? Because I think this is really interesting what's happening right now with the public discourse around FIFA and also our role as footballogists in what people know and how they access information and talk about it. Anyone?
Simon Cooper here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I just want to say I've been writing a lot, and I'm amazed at the appetite. I mean, we're all very close to this, so we're all obsessed with it. But it turns out the whole world is, including my newspaper, the Financial Times. I was very surprised about that. And the debate starts from a position of very little knowledge, of course. So the whole world is talking about something that the whole world has only been following closely for a very short time. And then I notice in the responses there's this idea that if you write as a Western commentator, you're inevitably blinded and pro-Western, and you can't see the virtues of Blatter, etc. And maybe that, I know I came to this conversation late, I know you've touched on this, maybe I am blinded by my Western perspective, but that seems to me a very popular take among readers about this.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I just had an interview with an Africa program on an NPR affiliate in California, KPFK, and they were really interested in this aspect of the story, suggesting that, you know, somehow there's a kind of scapegoating going on of Africans in particular, but also of Caribbeans and perhaps South Americans too. But it seems to me that, you know, corruption knows no geographical or cultural boundaries here. And if we want to have an opportunity to fix FIFA, something that's very, very difficult to do, we must call a spade and recognize that, you know, there's agency across these boundaries, and including, you know, in Africa. We're not just passive victims of Western conspiracies. And also, you know, this investigation started in the United States for crimes alleged to have taken place in Miami and New York. Chuck Blazer, of course, is an American. He has pleaded guilty to multiple counts of tax evasion and fraud, etc., money laundering. You know, I mean, it's not as if the West is you know, above this all. So it is rather striking how there's these assumptions that, you know, we're sort of playing out, you know, Cold War battles in some respects in this story.
Colonial battles.
And even, yeah, Cold War. And in some ways, maybe even late colonial ones, too.
But I think that's exactly, sorry, I'm just jumping in there. Tell me if I'm speaking out of turn.
No, please jump in. This kind of session was designed today for exactly this.
I think that's exactly, I think there's a kind of lack of definition, maybe, of what the issues here are. So, for example, when I portray the British media's rhetoric, I don't think, I mean, I agree the investigation started for crimes committed in the US with US citizens, but there is something that's not clear exactly as to why it's the US prosecution or the US justice system that stretched its arm out to police this game that hasn't, I mean, I'm not saying that's what I think, I'm just perceiving that this is a question that's not being answered clearly. And also that it's somehow excusable, perhaps more so in Britain, because the desire to cancel out the Qatar World Cup and somehow have it come back to England or to Britain is so steep. So no one's saying there's a tacit, it's not that not understanding Blatter's power or popularity is racist, for example, but I think it's just very interesting how I think the MO of these people, these men, who in a way actually started out being a bunch of people who wanted to create something that included them because England didn't particularly want so many foreigners in FIFA or whatever, or just to play, to get the countries that weren't holding power in Europe to play. And then the whole sponsorship, which I think is crucial, by the way, I'm glad Martha brought it up, because I think that's there's two things that are not being mentioned enough. And it's the role of the TV deals and the sponsors, not in issuing statements whether they respect or welcome or whatever Blatter's resignation or Blazer's confessions, but how intrinsically tied up with the whole business they are. So, you know, this seems to be an investigation into how World Cup host countries were allocated. And in fact, there's a lot more that needs to be looked at very thoroughly. And I just think because FIFA has grown to have such power and such world reach, it's not clearly accountable to anyone. And whereas it's a very positive thing that it should be held to account at some point because it was spiraling out of control, who it's is asking for the accounts and or who the, you know, that is issuing the warrants, to my mind, is questionable. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying I would like to understand more what it is that these crimes are and why it is that the US has taken it upon itself to request so many warrants around the world. And I think it's great that it's happened, but it should be raising all the issues and not just the issue of the dreadful Qataris or the South African 10 million. I mean, if you really think about it, it's not even that much money, really.
Chris, you were chatting here on the Skype. You want to maybe speak about what you're replying to Marcela's comment?
I think Marcela's comments are good. The point here, 10 million, irrespective of it was 10 million or 100 million, there was still bribery that took place. And I think that has to be rooted out. But to go back to my original point, this rhetoric from the mainstream media is that UEFA, the Europeans, and can save FIFA, save world football. In other words, they can be the custodians of the world game. Let's push this further. In other words, what they're saying is white people can save. In other words, people that are not white cannot run the game. And that, for me, is blatantly racist. And that's why I'm very uncomfortable with a lot of the reports coming out of mainstream US and European media as we speak.
So I would dispute that, actually. Simon Cooper here. I mean, are we saying, who is saying people who are not white can't run the game? And the chief villain in all this has been Sepp Blatter. I'm not sure that there is a statement that it's about black people. I mean, sure, Africans have been targeted, but as Peter said, people from around the world have been targeted as corrupt. And one of the two disputed World Cups is in a white European country. So, yes, there have been allegations against Africans, but there have been allegations against loads and loads of people. I mean, Blatter's rhetoric is always, any criticism of me and the African bloc is racist. I think we must be very careful of giving credence to that.
Roger Kittleson here. Simon, I think, you know, you have a good point there, because it is been so broad, and that, you know, goes back to this you know, sort of massive scheme that João Havelange really cooked up, and that Blatter's just kind of built upon. And that was really, you know, there's something to be said for the initial reasoning behind that, which was, you know, not simply to wring money out of this. That was, I think, always part of it, but, you know, also to break the European hold over the game and, you know, get more countries in from outside Europe. The problem is that it is so much of the world that what we end up with now is this, you know, rhetoric, you know, talking about Anglo-American takeover of the game, or attempted takeover of the game, which is, I hope, as ridiculous as it sounds. But, you know, in a way, who's left who, you know, has any kind of legitimacy, really? And I don't know if this is where, you know, the more thinking journalists and academics might have something to say. I don't know who the hell will listen to us, though, other than each other. But, you know, I have this distinct impression, though, that, you know, whatever we may talk about, you know, the several, you know, real powers in the Asian Football Confederation, for instance, are kind of, you know, having discussions with Blatter and others, and sort of figuring out who's going to be, you know, the next reform candidate. And I'm using scare quotes, which don't show up either on the audio or the typing here. So, thanks.
Anyone care to follow up?
Yeah, this is Tony.
Hi, Tony from
How
Illinois.
Are you? Yes. I've been listening to this. Great. Thanks for including me. Yeah, I would like to speak from the African perspective, not only that I'm an African, but it's what I'm reading from the African press. Eventually, Africa is feeling that they are being victimized because Blatter has supported Africa for so long and FIFA has helped develop football in Africa. I mean, there's always all the stories about corruption here, corruption there, but at the same time, we've ignored one aspect. The fans love soccer and they like the support that FIFA is getting, giving soccer. So this idea of corruption for many African people, as Martha has said earlier on, is seen as imperialism all over again, colonialism all over again. FIFA is the only place that Africans have their voice heard. One country, one vote, regardless of the size of the federation, regardless of the size of the country or the wealth of the country or the number of people, we all watch soccer. So now that Africans have a right and no country has a veto, the perception is that the Anglo-American now want to have veto powers at FIFA. And this is perceived by many Africans as corruption. So even though we can intellectualize or a journalist can write and say this has nothing to do with colonialism or racism, but the perception is out there. And when you go to the field to watch soccer, that's what you see. And that's what many soccer fans around the world see. Because I can also say that many of the viewers or fans of soccer live outside of America and Europe. And this will have more people voice, and they have more people watching soccer than Europeans and Anglo, or Europeans or Americans. So that's one perspective we must not ignore at all.
Interesting point. I find it difficult, Tony, to generalize on these kinds of things too. You know, I mean, I've heard lots of criticism of Blatter in South Africa, for example, from hardcore soccer fans, as you know, the national pastime in South Africa, the sport of the majority of the people, and they didn't like how Blatter and Valky, by the way, acted when they were in South Africa in the years building up to the World Cup, and when they were there during the World Cup. You know, they didn't like the fact that, you know, Blatter didn't have to use his passport, for instance, to come in and out of South Africa. It was a slap in the face of South African sovereignty. Or when he dragged Jacob Zuma, certainly not a beloved president then, and even less so now, by the hand like a little child on the pitch before the, or at the end, I can't remember, of the final. Maybe it was before the medal presentation, right? You don't do that. You don't drag a president of a country behind you like that. So I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it's difficult to generalize sometimes about such a vast and diverse place. But I think you're right about the perception is that Blatter certainly was more friendly to Africa than many other FIFA officials. Although I would argue that Avelange is largely responsible for that rather than Blatter. Blatter just refined that system. But there are lots of people here participating. Should we take it in a different direction? Because we've sort of focused on this particular angle for quite a bit. Anyone want to pick up the ball and run?
I just want to make a point in terms of, you know, the person who's started all this in terms of the states, you know, in terms of, you know, turning states evidence, if you will, how Chuck Blazer got into this game, how he got involved to begin with. I mean, the smiley face pin guy got involved because he was a youth soccer coach and saw an opportunity here in Westchester County, where I'm also a youth soccer coach. And I see the opportunists taking advantage of the situation all around me. And I see this as a problem holding back the growth of the game for two generations now here in the States. We've come a long way with soccer in the States, but, you know, again, the moneylenders need to be cleaned out of the temple. That's what needs to happen. And I think pointing the finger in terms of East, West, white, dark, and those kind of identity politics games here is, I'm sorry, beside the point. What's at stake here is the game that you and I all love, and I've kicked the ball around with some of you. And that's really what this is about. It's about keeping the ball rolling. And I think some people, at least in the American media, would love to just dismiss soccer as a corrupt game that's not worthy of our attention. It has picked up popular attention here now, and soccer is once again front page news without the World Cup being played. But you know, it's in the news being mocked. It's being disgraced. And we need to clean it up, and we need to figure that out. And I think it, you know, we need to look at the game's governance and modify the game's governance. And I think we need to look at how those corporate entities handle all this. I mean, this is small potatoes, the money we're actually talking about, passing hands, right? When we talk about corporate greed, I mean, you know, I wish our attorney general would be so aggressive with the banks that have laundered the very money that we're concerned with here.
Sorry, that's a bit long-winded, but
the kids that I'm coaching are the sons of the bankers who work for these banks that laundered the money. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe.
Sorry, I'm sorry, I missed that. There was a crackle. Would you mind repeating that? The sons of the bankers, and then
I'm not friends with Chuck Blazer, but many of my friends are, and I'm just being honest on this.
Yeah, they
tell me some wonderful things. And he got into this. He did not grow up like so many of us playing the game. I grew up playing the game. My father taught me how to kick a ball. Chuck Blazer did not grow up playing the game, but he got involved as a soccer dad. And he was coaching his – and he saw an opportunity, right? And that's the thing. Who is vulnerable to corruption? If you've never had the opportunity to be corrupt, it's really easy for you to cast stones. He who is without sin cast the first stone. I'm sorry to get all evangelical here, but I – this is my religion, and I know it's everyone on this call. This is our religion we're talking about here. But he saw an opportunity in Westchester County, New York, that the kids that I'm coaching, their parents are, by and large, right? And so they see corruption as just part of is the Attorney General of the United States so interested in such a tiny thing. I mean, as big as the global game is, the corruption that's happened in our banking system really deserves more attention. I'm not saying that this investigation and these prosecutions shouldn't happen. No, I'm not saying that at all. I think it's wonderful. Let's catch the crooks. Let's get them out. But we need to set up systems of governance that don't facilitate this kind of thing happening. Because just like the Who's saying it, you know, I don't want to get fooled again. We're going to keep getting fooled again. And as one very, very powerful figure in world soccer said to me off the record when I said, hey, did you hear the news? And he hadn't heard the news. And I told him, hey, Blatter just resigned. He said to me, so what? I don't know what he meant by so what. I really don't know what he meant by so what. But then he followed it up by saying, FIFA's an international organization and Blatter's an individual. But the media like to demonize with just individuals. We need to look at the context that allows those individuals to emerge.
I mean,
who's jumping in here? There was a hand up. I think it was Daniel.
Yeah. I mean, okay. The governance structure is certainly key. And if you have in the FIFA executive committee only 22 people making important decisions, of course, it's much easier to influence such processes, corruption, than if 209 people make a decision, even if it doesn't mean that there won't happen corruption then. But maybe we have to think about like revolutionary suggestions, like how, what do you think if World Cups do not taking place anymore in just single countries? How if a World Cup is taking place on a continent maybe, and it's rotating from continent to continent? I think the Euro 2020 is quite interesting and promising idea to have it in like a dozen or so countries. So maybe, I mean, if there would be such an automatic process that it's rotating like from continent to continent, then the whole excitement about the bidding would be away. So I think maybe we need such revolutionary suggestions instead of just making like gradual changes in the processes.
Martha, you have 2 points and questions.
Yeah, okay. So this is, I mean, it's I think it, from the American perspective, somebody said that, oh, yeah, well, bladder, who cares about that? It is true that we're not really invested the same way in the ins and outs of FIFA and all that. And I'm curious that we have our own here in the United States. I mean, the NCAA, you know, has been through different aspects of corruption at different levels, issues around governance, issues around how they treat the players. Other organizations, other sports organizations here in the United States also have issues. And I'm wondering, can we collectively think of a sports organization which would be a model? Is it table tennis? They seem to have something going on there that seems to work. Are there other sports organizations? And that said, I mean, table tennis doesn't have as, you know, near the profile as football. And is that just the problem? I mean, it's just so popular around the world that, you know, the it's going to be a hard horse to ride, just no matter what, no matter what kinds of things we come up with. So, you know, I think and somebody's like the NCAA, you know, it could be. Yeah, Peter, yes, it could be. So I'm just curious, though, are there things that we already know from our other sporting experiences that could help? The other sort of query question just has to do with the, you know, the observation some people have made on how it's so funny how this comes out right before the Women's World Cup. And, you know, the women's roles have always, you know, women's involvement in sports has always sort of stood, perhaps not correctly, but stood as somehow the clean version of sport. You know, that's a whole nother question there. But I've seen a couple of points made that for all the corruption and the amounts of money that they're talking about, they could have easily played on grass pitches in Canada. That was something they could have done easily and not had to worry about the cost there. So those are my two points.
Simon Cooper here. Could I just briefly respond to Marta's points? Hi, can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yep. Go ahead, Simon. Yep.
A model might be WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency. Roger Pielke suggested this to me because they have government ministers on their foundation board, although Blatter is also, of course, on the foundation board. But maybe you need roles for various governments as well, completely contrary to FIFA tradition, so that it's not just a bunch of football associations doing favours for each other. And the other point about women's football, I mean, yes, it is much cleaner, but on the other hand, there's much less money in it, so it's kind of easier to be clean if you're a corrupt person. A very bad place to start trying to make some illegitimate money would be women's football. So it's easier to be clean if you're not lucrative.
Sorry, I also have a point to Martha's point, although I take on board Simon's recommendation not to start stealing big amounts of money in women's football. I think the problem with finding model organisations is that there's nothing quite like FIFA. I mean, one could look at sporting organisations or anti-doping or international, but I think it's more akin to something like the United Nations, which is not to say that's a good example of anything. Or even, I mean, I was using the analogy of the Oscars, the Academy Awards in films. I mean, it's a very big show, and it happens to be the most popular show in the world at World Cup level, which isn't at all the only thing FIFA does, but it is their biggest market, if you like. So it's this way that they grew to be so big that no one can quite hold them to account, and that there are no existing models of what kind of an organization it should be. But it has to be invented, very much as FIFA itself was invented not that long ago.
Yeah, I mean, FIFA was invented by the French, by and large, and indeed it was headquartered in Paris until World War II. And, you know, should we take it out of Switzerland? Does that hold a little bit of hope for transparency, accountability, good governance, so on? Because it seems to me that there's a reason why the IOC and UEFA and FIFA and, you know, every big-time drug dealer and arms dealer and gangster and crook has their money in Switzerland. Yeah. Is that not the case? Would that move us into a closer to a better future for world football in addition to all the political stuff?
Yeah, Peter, just in you talking, one of the questions that I thought of earlier was, what if if the group had the opportunity to have the ear of someone or to invent someone that were a candidate, what would the key pillars of their candidacy be? That idea of moving FIFA to Switzerland is a really interesting one. I'm not sure if I want to segue back into the conversation, but I think any candidate that I would support would have to answer both, I think, what Chris started this conversation with and also a little bit of what David's talking about is, yes, reform around the structures of governance is important, but it's not identity politics. I mean, we're all scholars at different levels of the game, but the game carries its lucrative appeal because it touches into the human experience, which is, you know, shaped by colonialism and countries that prior to people like Avalanche and Blatter weren't getting a chunk of the pie that has done a lot of good in developing grassroots football. But it shouldn't be a one or the other. An exciting candidate would be one that would speak to those kinds of legacies that that people like Stanley Rouse embodied, but also says, you know, let's not make Blatter out to be a saint because he knew how to work FIFA's governance system. But what would you all think would be kind of rallying cries around a good candidate?
David is raising his hand.
I'm sorry. I hope I'm not talking too much, but just so passionate about this, like everyone else, and I just believe in the power of the beautiful game. But I think we need some kind of more shared governance that starts with term limits, and I think perhaps a two-chamber approach. I mentioned this in the Skype texting there, the idea of a two-chamber approach. The idea of one nation, one vote. I do want to cling to that, and I respect that. I understand that. But some balance with proportional representation and then shared governance where, there are term limits and maybe those term limits are also connected to, confederations where the leadership, executive leadership rotates through. We need to restructure the governance of the game. And we need to do it at all levels of the game. Peter, I just see you made the point in text there. The term limits don't work that well in the U.S., but I would say even, just within the academic context, most of us on this call are academics. Shared governance within the academic context, right? If even in your department, if someone's chair for terms, power corrupts. And the longer you have it, the more vulnerable. In my view, and so sharing governance around, so it does, is one piece of a larger puzzle that I think we need to consider. I also want to add that I think as academics, first of all, it's great to have Simon on this call, but I think we need to make sure that our voices are heard on this. Rather than just the journalists who, Simon being one of the great, great exceptions to the rule, by and large, most of the people covering this don't know what they're talking about.
And how can we do that, David, as a group, if not individually? How would you suggest? Any ideas or others on the call?
Before I left Sunday, I was interviewed on Headlines Today in India about this issue. Is this just a point of despair? Has the beautiful game been turned ugly too much? And I said, well, on an individual grassroots level, just start contacting their funding this. Just start expressing your disgust that the guilt by association of their product makes you want to turn away. So I think we just need to speak out anywhere and everywhere. To try to clean up our game.
One thing, Marcela, I think your mic is open.
That's my text.
My mic? I don't think so.
Oh, okay. This is some kind of like coffee grinder like noise happening.
Yes, I heard it too, but it's not me.
Whoever's grinding coffee.
It's my lovely coffee. No, it's not me.
One was David and one was Marcella. It wasn't clear.
One thing real quick there too. I appreciate what you're saying, David. And I've read things that have made me cringe, and Chris has pointed to this too at the start of the call. But I actually think there's a lot of good journalists that are doing a lot of good things to shape this narrative in a way that I haven't seen one dominant narrative, even in the United States, and what I've been reading in Argentina. It's just one perspective that I have, but some of the most nuanced voices that I've heard that have been giving excellent historical context and identifying the key structural issues, both in FIFA as an organization and also how soccer is experienced all over the world, have been journalists who really cross those boundaries between they've written books, they teach courses in some senses, but are primarily journalists. Tim Vickery and Philippe Auclair had probably the most interesting debate on an Irish radio station, and Tim Vickery was spot on with his analysis of a long view of the history of FIFA and why someone like Blatter exists in the first place.
I just think that few journalists are well prepared to understand the structure and governance of the game. I think Simon again being one of the few who understands the role of finance in that. Along with that, most journalists rely upon their sources to such a degree that they only are willing to go so far, and they also have the pressure of deadlines that we as academics don't have to face as much. Don't laugh at me about missing deadlines.
No, I think that's a valid point. Simon, what do you think?
Yeah, I was just going to say on Wednesday, I was at a dinner in Holland. Was it Wednesday, Tuesday? And the newspaper called me and said, can you write now? And I said, what's happened? And Blatter resigned. And so I wrote a 1,200-word article in 45 minutes. Now, you will read that article and you will find it superficial. You'll probably find it wrong. You'll probably find it point missing. But I would say, guys, I did that in 45 minutes. And very few journalists cover FIFA day in, day out. I mean, almost nobody has it as a speciality. So suddenly you're plunged into this. A lot of journalists are writing about FIFA every single day. And it's sort of easy, I feel, for an academic to say, oh, well, they don't have the historical overview, they don't have the nuance. I mean, try it, guys. I think journalists need academics, is what I've always said. And I wish you were more accessible to us. And I want to quote some of you guys. I'll check quotes after this conversation, but I'm making notes. I won't quote anyone without checking with them first. This is very helpful and useful to me. So I would say, please, let's bring the two sides together. I'm not sure about protecting sources. I mean, it seems to me that journalists, if they were protecting any sources, most of them have burned their boats pretty thoroughly. We've been incredibly mean to almost everybody in football.
Yeah, this reminds me of our discussion at Hofstra last year.
Yeah.
When we had the plenary panel on journalistic and academic writing on football that was unfortunately derailed in part by a rather off-topic rant or two. That's one of the things that the Football Scholars Forum, I think, tries to do is to bring, these various points of view and approaches together and have these productive discussions.
Peter, I just want to say that I didn't think it got derailed, being in the audience there at that. I didn't contribute to the discussion in that hour and a half, whatever it was. But it was, you got the sense of just different discourse realms that just weren't familiar with one another whatsoever. And Simon's making such a fantastic point, right? As academics, we need to engage journalists just as we need to hope that journalists engage us. And a point you've made several times before, Peter, that, you can be suspicious of that when you feel your work is being exploited or you're not credited properly. But now is really the time where all of us need to write and think together for the good of the game. Sorry, I'm sermonizing. I'm sorry.
Very good point. There's some conversation going on in the chat window here about academic complicity also in propping up FIFA World, FIFA Land, whatever you want to call it, the system, the man. It's not just journalists who do that, and I think that's an important point to make too. Anyone want to comment or jump in right now?
I think, sorry, I will. I think it's often the way when one has a certain amount of expertise, knowledge, and then sees something breaking in the media at such speed, like this week, that the feeling is it's being covered superficially, or there isn't enough in-depth knowledge, and journalism, and certainly breaking news, which is what this week has been all about. It's about running after the story, is never going to be the proper forum for an in-depth revolutionary change of the structures that are there, and of course the media could certainly feed more of academia if the academics are accessible, if they're correctly credited, and if there was the time and the scope and the depth within journalism to look for such expertise. But I think of a very big part of this story is that actually the media is entirely complicit. And that's what I think was mentioned early on by Martha with the sponsors. And it's not just the sponsors, but it's the media itself that carries the message of the sponsors and the game itself. And that's how this whole industry spiraled. And I think it's really interesting to see how the focus is always concentrated on certain areas in a huge story like this, where if we're going to start discussing, you know, after Thierry Henry's handball, how much money the Irish FA got for or not got, and so on, and that level of details, and we haven't even started going on to on-the-pitch events yet, but there must be, like, so much that could possibly come out with match-fixing and results and refereeing and all that. Yeah, and the media is such a crucial player in this, as are the sponsors, that I just don't think it's almost possible for that kind of meta-vision in journalism as we know it today. I just think most of the massive news organizations, corporations in the world are FIFA partners to a greater or lesser extent. And that's why I think it's so interesting how this has come about on the back of, some kind of tax evasion from Blazer, because there are so many details that could have triggered it all off, and they haven't. And why aren't we seeing them emerge more, or will we? And what is the role of the media in it all, other than commentating as if it's something happening entirely outside its realm?
Well, it was happening outside my realm, I have to say, Simon here.
Yes.
Britain has this huge problem of libel law. You couldn't say a week ago Blatter is corrupt, because he would sue you. So there's an enormous problem. Media lacks resources to investigate. But in 20 years writing for the Financial Times, they've never said to me, you can't write that because X is a sponsor or an advertiser. They've never, ever said or suggested
anything
like that.
The FT aren't rights holders. They're not football rights holders.
No, well, no newspaper is. No newspaper holds rights to the Football World Cup. So we're all free to write what we like. There isn't. I don't see an enormous holding back. FIFA's had enormous amounts of criticism from newspapers for a very long time. I'm not sure in what way newspapers are complicit with FIFA. I can see that if you're the rights holders of the World Cup, then you are hampered in what you can say, yes, but those are only a few television channels.
Can you all think of any examples? I'm struggling to find one here, but, you know, Simon, Marcela, people like David who've also participated in the forum, to have some kind of a middle ground, a meeting place to have a long-form investigative piece that taps into the kind of work that's possible in the academic monograph and journal article that has a turnover rate that is, you know, David was talking in the chat. He said, you know, the amount of words that you wrote in 45 minutes takes him much longer. Have you been able to do this kind of stuff in, I mean, someone just struck me, Simon, your work with Stefan.
Yeah, oddly, in Soccernomics, there's almost no mention of FIFA. I mean, I've done a couple of longer pieces for the FT on FIFA. But one problem is, I mean, to unroot corruption, I mean, it took the FBI to do it. The FBI has a lot more resources than any newspaper. But let's say that I had those documents. I wouldn't have been able to write about them in the Financial Times because much milder things I've tried to write about Blatter have been pulled by our lawyers. Because, you know, under British libel law, they could get the newspaper sued for millions. So if I'd have had all the FBI's documents, I wouldn't have been able to write anything. And, of course, you know, as newspapers, as journalists, we have very few resources of time and money. You know, I can't go around the world and investigate Miami bank accounts, et cetera, on the newspaper's dime.
And just this is Roger jumping in. I mean, the British libel law looks a little scary from a U.S. perspective, but certainly is much better than what happens in places like Brazil. I mean, you know, Juca Kafori has been writing about this sort of stuff since the 70s, and he has a lawyer on retainer just because he gets sued on a pretty much on a monthly basis, usually just spuriously. It's a fact of life. You have to be able to, you know, have the resources to fight back, which is really, really tough because journalists are not particularly well paid, in most places in the world. Certainly not in Brazil, but all right, thanks.
Simon, what about the Guardian newspaper in the UK? Do you think it navigates these very, very stringent constraints in a slightly different way? How is it seen there among the professionals in the field, if not the wider audience?
Well, I mean, I admire the Guardian. I read it. They're subject to the same libel law as we are, in that they would be sued if they wrote. They wrote stuff. They might be a bit braver. That's possible. Their libel laws might be, lawyers might be more willing to let them do stuff. But, I mean, The Guardian's not a newspaper. It's a gigantic website. It's a ragbag of millions of different people, some of whom are not journalists but are doing investigations off their own bat, a lot of whom are people writing opinion and academics. So it's not really a newspaper in the same way the Financial Times is a newspaper. So they have lots of different stuff. And The Guardian is incredibly influential because of its reach, but it's very poorly resourced. So I'm not aware of a Guardian investigation that uncovered stuff about FIFA. In fact, the only newspaper that really seems to have done that is the Sunday Times.
I mean, that's right, famously so, and has been, you know, was criticized by Blatter and his crew very harshly.
Well, one of the issues in all this is that the British media is read around the world just because it's in English and because it covers football. And then FIFA sees it as an action by the British people, if you like, representing the English Football Association. So, and then I guess people in Africa are sometimes inclined to see also it's all these forces are aligned. The British media, the English FA, and the British government are the same, just as the FBI represents the US Soccer Federation in the minds of many. And I think it's important to disentangle the different institutions. I mean, I don't take orders from the UK government or even from the Football Association. I am not aware of any football journalist who does. Although, obviously, on the other hand, there is widespread pique in England about the handing out of the World Cups. That is also true. But the disentangling the institutions and not seeing each nation as acting like a bloc is important in this.
I think most academics would agree with you know, that kind of problematizing. I had a point and I sort of forgot what I was going to say. It'll come back to me. Anyone want to intervene here? We're now running into added time for this Flash FSF session.
What do you all think is going to happen in the next 4 or 5 months?
Ruani, you raised your hand.
Well, I just want to say from the I've been following the news in Costa Rica because of Eduardo Lee, who is, of course, famously the one who got escorted out with the bedsheet from the hotel. And it's really interesting to see the reaction there with the Fede Futbol and how they've been in many ways, you get this double conversation going on. Some people saying, you know, poor guy, he, you know, made a mistake. He shouldn't have been playing that game. And others thinking that, good, this is time to fix the Fede Football, to do some serious reforms to Costa Rican soccer, and to be a voice of reform in CONCACAF, which obviously has been the most affected. So I think it's really curious to take the cases sort of at a national level, particularly with nations that are primarily known for their soccer, but are small enough to, that they don't, you know, see themselves mattering on the geopolitical level, but suddenly they're in the news. And I think the Eduardo Lee case is really interesting. I know there's been articles recently about his health, you know, what type of diet he's receiving in jail, people praying for him. On the other hand, like I said, you know, it was about time, and people are starting to save themselves, I guess, off the ship that's sinking. And that's not unlike what's going on in other soccer federations.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Who's intervening?
I think for the next month, the question is what's going to happen in Switzerland. There seems to be some discussion, some pressure to change Swiss laws. This is the one interesting question. And the other one is, is a window of opportunity for change now. There's so much public pressure in the whole world. And, UEFA, they were quiet at last week's meeting. But, I mean, it might be now a window of opportunity to install some, like, oversight measures, like involving maybe human rights groups into FIFA. I mean, the whole governance structure, this is difficult to predict, but it needs to change. It will be very interesting to see what is changing in the next months.
Who's going to win the election in December or March or whenever it takes place at FIFA? Anyone?
I'm told Sheikh Ahmad, the Kuwaiti, has a very good chance.
This is the son of the famous Sheikh who went onto the pitch during the France-Kuwait game in 1982.
Oh, really? That's amazing.
Yeah, James Dorsey had a post on him and sort of Asia Confederation politics within FIFA. Very interesting. If Middle East Soccer is his blog, if you want to check that out. Mm-hmm. Anyone else got an opinion on the election and who might be in the driver's seat or what might happen in the investigation? The noose appears to be tightening, I hear.
It just seems like the DOJ is sitting on much more with Blazer and that they've been playing this more carefully than we might realize. I don't think it's a coincidence that after he's not stepped down, I think this has been an important point too. You know, a lot of people have been talking about Blatter stepping down. He's not stepping down yet. But then the DOJ expands to name him as someone under investigation.
We do have Kevin, who just came in from putting his son to bed, I think. And there was a question posed to him. I don't know if it's fair to bring him into the discussion at the tail end, but he's having problems with his connection, so maybe we'll pass on that. Anyone else? There's so many of you on the call. Surely there are a few more opinions about what's in store for the future.
Simon Cooper, I'm just going to channel Roger Pielke, who said to me, does it matter who gets re-elected as long as the structure stays the same? 209 associations vote, so it remains a patronage organization. You'd have to reform the structure, and is there any chance of that happening? We can all devise a clean structure for FIFA. That's not so difficult. There are a lot of organizations in the world with clean structures, but who is going to implement it? It seems very unlikely to me.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Simon. Reform from within doesn't leave me with a lot of optimism or hope that it will improve all that much. But David Goldblatt is circulating his manifesto for the People's Football Congress, which may go public very soon. Some of you have received it by email, but it's a sort of a world social forum of sport. And that could be a way to continue to exercise external pressure. And I think external pressure seems to be one of the only forces that does spark some substantive change. The IOC, I think, only changed after Salt Lake City, for instance, and the doping scandal. So maybe that's one way to look at it. And academics certainly can play a role in the People's Football Congress. Others more optimistic about FIFA's capacity to change from within?
How much did the IOC really change, though? I mean, is it a completely clean and transparent and fantastic institution? I mean, was it a really radical change?
It was mostly... No, go ahead.
Please, go ahead.
Well, my understanding is that the IOC changes were, fairly strong, but faded over time. And again, from a Brazilian perspective, via Central Connecticut, things don't look too terribly different from FIFA. Certainly a bit better, but again, just sort of degrees of badness, and not quite asking for the same degree of sovereignty in host nations and so on, but and not apparently as drastically corrupt at the top, but the reforms seem to have been more show than play.
I just wanted to, I'm sorry, Roger, to step on your work there. I just want to say the IOC's got that weird situation in terms of each sport that they oversee has its own world governing bodies, and then, of course, the national federations there. And if you want to look at the I don't know about any ideal models of sport governance, but if you want to look at sport corruption, look no further than handball. So it's not just that soccer is so corrupt. The question really is what sports are not, and if they aren't, how do they keep themselves clean? Again, I just don't want us to throw out the baby with the bathwater, and I'm so worried about soccer being damaged with all the attention it's receiving. It's not that we shouldn't have that attention; we need it, but we need to work together. And yeah, maybe David's notion of the People's Football Congress is something we all need to really, really get on board with. Maybe that's the most practical thing we can do right now. I don't know.
We won't have to call it slow football or anything like that, right? Like slow food or any of that groovy stuff.
I guess something that I would feel very passionate about too, though, is that as academics, we be frank about our broken system of scholarly communication and not kid ourselves that conferences, are our way of are communicating to a wider public. Congresses are fantastic for forming communities, and look what we've been able to do just virtually versus the excitement that we had when we all got together in Hofstra. But I think this is what the exchange that you had with Simon there is really about, with the immediacy of communication that journalists have access to, whereas what our training as academics best prepares us to do, and needing to have a middle ground there where expertise, scholarly communication, and the immediacy and wide scope of journalistic work can come together, because it is people that need to read these things, and as academics we have a good track record in some ways of that with particular examples, but as a community it's not particularly strong. But that's just me.
Anyone else, Danielle or Matt or Tony, Martha, anyone? Chris,
Hi, Peter. Can I just Steven. Throw something in? I would have liked to hear the point on the ongoing crisis. I put it, actually, I typed it, CS, Centre International d'Etudes sur le Sport, which is actually a think tank financed by FIFA, but probably they're not allowed to talk about it. So that was something interesting, because actually they award money for research as well, and so I was wondering.
Well, we do. Is Kevin on the call? Has he made it in? He sent me a note about it, but he doesn't seem to be in. Kevin,
he actually commented a couple of times, but I don't know if he's listening.
Okay. Well, I can give you my two cents. Alex might have something to say.
Oh, please, because actually quite a few of us benefited from the João Avalanche Scholarship. Alex did. I don't know if you did, Peter. I was just wondering if somebody wants to research corruption among FIFA, if he applies for the grants, would they consider him seriously? Or any other kind of just to talk about it a little bit.
It's a black box. We don't know how many people apply, what money's given to who, criteria is specific but fairly loose on what
absolutely yeah
what qualifies as scholarship worthy of funding. So it's an excellent thing that exists and that. It's allowed a lot of wonderful research to happen, but it is very much a black box. Very different applying for a Fulbright than it was for applying for a FIFA grant.
Yeah, I don't see CS funding anything like that in the near future.
Maybe John Oliver's show will fund us.
But I'll tell you what, those documents with the financial numbers of the sponsorship contracts and so on are not going to be seen by any independent researcher anytime soon. I can pretty much guarantee you that.
Or maybe we can crowdfund it.
Yeah, there you go. We can crowdfund it
and have John Oliver put a hashtag up. And there you go. Problem solved.
Yeah, but that's another advantage of working with the United States justice system. As somebody who's very familiar with the Italian and the South African justice system, I have to say the American one is fairly functional, sometimes too harsh perhaps, but it's also transparent. I mean, we can get these transcripts. We can get a lot of these documents. The ones we don't, we can make freedom of information requests for. And that is, I think, one of the only ways we can start digging into these dynamics of corruption and bribery. Because if we wait for FIFA to unlock the vault, we'll be long gone from this planet. The other thing I wanted to just point out is that the European Union has been rather loudly silent in this entire operation. And I'm very curious about France and Germany in particular. Maybe it's too late to introduce this, but I'm keeping my ears open and eyes open to see if there's any movement there, because I haven't heard anything of substance come out of Brussels. And I think that's very revealing in some ways.
Can I just say, speaking from Paris, France voted for Blatter, Platini voted for Qatar, and Jerome Falk was, a senior French football official before he became a FIFA official. Oddly, a senior French government official said to me, how can France help clean up FIFA? I really don't think France can help clean up FIFA if it's profiting from it at the same time. So France is knee-deep in it. And as Daniel Reich, he says, Qatar's heavily investing in France. France desperately needs Qatar to sell their airplanes too. So the idea that there's a European front, for better or worse, it's just not true. I mean, once France, Russia, and Spain are not part of that, there is no European front. Not to mention, as Stephen said, various Eastern European countries which have far more Blatterite instincts in their football associations, I mean.
Anything similar for Germany, you'd say, Simon, as for France?
I think Germany's been very cautious because Zwanziger has been quite critical now. But, Germany was not very critical of FIFA in preceding years, and certainly not when they got the World Cup and would have seen how FIFA works from the inside and would have been as aware of anyone of FIFA corruptness. So it's also that the outsiders complain. You know, England complains correctly, but England complains because it's an outsider. Germany didn't complain when it was an insider. Now it's more liable to complain. So Germany, like the US, the US Soccer Federation, has not been very brave. So I'm not quite sure where this angry European front is that's going to clean up FIFA, or indeed take FIFA away from the Africans and make it a European-wide dominated institution. I don't see that European action.
Interestingly, in the German media, there were like commentaries that the head of the German Football Association, Wolfgang Niersbach, would be a good candidate for FIFA president. So there were like several articles which were like heavily promoting him and writing him. It was clever not to stand up at the FIFA Congress because he might be now a good candidate, like everybody might be, agree on. But I'm not sure how realistic this is. But just as an information, that's from the German-speaking media.
Okay, well, I think we've run out of time here. We're now past injury time and maybe even in extra time. Questions keep popping up. I think this is a conversation that, of course, is just beginning. I'd like to bring it to a close by thanking everyone for participating. And hopefully, Alex, you can share the Google Doc or whatever you're going to use for the FIFA syllabus that we're going to create, so that, you know, we have a common pool of knowledge and resources that we can draw upon to continue these conversations. And if anyone wants to conclude with a final statement, now's the time to do it, because I think we're about to wrap it up.
Hey, Peter, this is Tony. Yeah. I think it would be nice next time when we have this sort of conversation, get some people from the African continent, not only that I'm an African, and also get some people from Asia to talk, because this would be very helpful to have a good debate from the other side of the ocean.
Yeah, Igabo Chipande from Lusaka was supposed to intervene, but I'm not sure what happened. And we've had people also. James Dorsey has participated, as have others. Daniel, when he's in Beirut. But it's very difficult in multiple time zones, you know, to make it all work. But we try our best, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But very important to have multiple voices and perspectives, for sure. Okay, thank you all. We're going to make the audio available over the next few days. So if you want to check it, you can. And also our new website has been migrated to the new server, footballscholars.org, with past sessions, recordings, bibliographies, syllabi, film lists, and so on and so forth. So check that out and keep an eye on Zurich, of course.